ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Well, I have an announcement to make. I changed the programming for today and tomorrow. Pastor Butch Paul could not be with us today. He's still taking care of his wife, Marcia, after her shoulder surgery. So I thought, well, let's play my broadcast with James Corbett today, Thursday, and tomorrow, Friday, Pastor Butch will be able to join me live for the program. So, today is April 4th, Thursday, 2019. I am doing my 20-minute of fame segment today, and for the second and third segment, James Corbett will be here, and it will be a little more timely because we did talk a little bit about the trade agreement or the discussions that are going on with the United States and China. So it's a little more timely. So you are listening to Financial Survival. I am Melody Cedarstrom, and today you're going to hear James Corbett for the second and third segment, and Pastor Butch will be here tomorrow. Now, hopefully I do not have you confused, so let's go to the markets, because that's always something that seems to confuse everyone. So gold today actually had a nice day. Let me go ahead and bring that up today. Gold in the New York spot price aftermarket was up $360 at $1,294. We had a low of $1,280. So a big move to the upside there. Silver saw the same type of a day. We broke $1,500 all the way down to $1,486. But she came back. $15.25 in the New York spot price aftermarket, up 4 cents. Platinum had a great day. Up $29, 3.33%, hitting 900. I told you, ladies and gentlemen, that those were going to reverse, and we saw palladium down 3% at $42 at $1,371. So kudos on those of you who sold your palladium. It's still not too late. Platinum is still a great buy, even at 900. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. The USDX today was up 0.20. So it's interesting to see the dollar. Yeah, we did have pressure earlier in the day, but even with the dollar up 0.20 at 97.29, gold recovered. Crude oil down 33 cents at 62.13. The paper markets, I do believe, you know, they were on a tear today. I think the Dow was up triple digits. Yes, correct. 166 points. 26,384. The NASDAQ was down 3 points at 7,891. And the S&P was up 6 at 2,879. So not a lot of movement there in the S&P and the NASDAQ. And I'm not quite sure. There was some reporting out about the latest on the Boeing, that the pilots of the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 followed proper procedure, but they were not able to control the aircraft before it crashed. And, of course, these findings are part of a preliminary report of the tragedy that was produced by the ministry, are likely to place significant pressure on Boeing. And Boeing did not immediately respond to the report. India's central bank cut interest rates for the second time in 2 months on Thursday, which is today. And, of course, right before a crucial election. So they're in the same game that every other country is in. The Reserve Bank of India lowered the rate at which it lends to banks from 6.25% to 6%, and of course citing a domestic and a global economic slowdown. You don't hear anybody talking about a slowdown here, but the Reserve Bank of India says a global economic slowdown as one of the main factors. Tesla's had their shares plunge 7% today in extended trading after the company reported a massive sales drop. The British pound edged a little bit higher today after they voted to force the UK government to request another extension to the Brexit process. We're going to talk a little bit about that with James Corbett here in a few minutes, so I won't do too much there. And, We have the U.S. Jobs report tomorrow, Friday. So that will be an interesting number, and I would think that that number will likely move markets one way or another. So there was a lot of interesting news out today. Herman Cain's appointment as a Federal Reserve governor, that looks to be moving forward. He was the Godfather's Pizza CEO for the central bank appointment in January, was rumored to be under consideration. And it was reported today that President Donald Trump is just about ready to submit his name to the Senate, but is awaiting the completion of Cain's background check. However, Bloomberg News did confirm that Trump was selecting Cain at age 73. And, you know, so the Fed would get someone who has some experience in central banking, but he is 73. Not that 73 is old by any means anymore as we move up there. But and he has served in multiple positions from 1989 to 1996 as the Kansas City Fed. And but he's not in line with President Trump's thinking for or the preferred low rates. In 2014, he had warned the Fed that they couldn't keep holding the benchmark interest rate near zero. So they do differ there. So it's kind of interesting to see that change in Cain's views, I guess, because we all know Trump's, you know, how he feels about these rates being increased. But and it's interesting, for those of you who don't know who Cain is, he made his fortune as a chief executive of Godfather's Pizza. He actually launched a bid for the Republican presidential nomination in 2012. I kind of like the guy. He actually led the opinion polls for a while during the Republican nominating contest, but he had his signature 999 tax proposal. And that would have levied a flat 9% corporate income and sales tax. But, you know, his popularity sort of slipped. There was sexual harassment allegations from several women. He did deny as completely false. But, you know, that, you know, it's like, can't any of these guys, aren't any of these guys, you know, can't they watch themselves? I mean, So much of this going around, but whether it be true or not, it's it seems like that's the easiest thing that, and who wants to prove it? You don't ever want to, you know, dig too deep in a lot of these areas and so forth. Nobody wants to talk about it, so maybe that's why everybody points to sexual harassment, because you know, either you have solid proof like pictures or you don't. And unfortunately, we saw the same thing happen with Kavanaugh and everything. And you know, it's just it just makes everyone you know, it's easy to lie. But something else I found interesting, you know, myself included, often urge everyone to call on their local politicians. Get involved in local politics. This is where you can make a difference. You know, maybe we can begin to see changes in the bigger picture. Changes start at home, right? Well, I guess the Democratic Socialists of America have decided to do the same thing. And this is relating to Chicago only, but I believe it's happening everywhere around this country, in your communities, in your local politics. Chicago, socialism is surging in city council. They had a total of 5 Democratic socialists and possibly a 6th who won races for aldermen, both in February or in Tuesday's runoff elections. There is a 6th candidate, and she's trailing the longtime alderman Deb Mell by only a few dozen votes. Now, this alderman Mell, the family, whose family has represented the 33rd ward for more than 40 years. This is the problem. 40 years of family that is running and represented the 33rd what is wrong with that picture? There's a lot. But two members backed by the Democratic Socialists of America won in the first round in February, and three more DSA, Democratic Socialists of America supported candidates won in the runoff. Their wins do mirror a trend nationally. And of course, the most notably one is the one we all know, Socialist Rep Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'm beginning to sound like Beth at CSC Talk Radio. But there are many new faces at City Hall now, and about half of the aldermen were either elected or appointed after 2015 or won their seats for the first time this year. So dangerous. They're starting locally. They're starting in the little communities. This is how you're going to spread. This is how the Democratic Socialists of America is going to spread. So now it's up to us to make sure you get out there and vote in your local affairs, because that's, you know, that's where you, that's, it's, or don't. I don't care, you know, but you'll be, you'll be addressing the socialists of America. And I don't think that's the road we want to go down. Today, President Trump announced that he would give Mexico a year to stem the flow of illegal drugs and migrants over the southern border. If the country cannot, he said, if the country cannot, let me restate that. He would give Mexico a year to stem the flow of illegal drugs and migrants over the southern border. And if the country cannot, he would impose auto tariffs. And then if that didn't work, he would close the border. He says, you know, I will do it. He doesn't play games. So we're doing it to stop people. We're going to give them a one-year warning. And if the drugs don't stop or largely stop, we're going to put tariffs on Mexico and products on particular cars. I thought we were already going to close the borders because of the immigration problems that they're having. He continues to say that if Mexico doesn't apprehend these people coming in the United States from Central America, we're going to tax the cars. And if that doesn't work, we're going to close the border. He repeats it. My question is it Mexico's responsibility to apprehend these people because the United States can't enforce immigration laws or reform the laws to strengthen these policies? Is it Mexico's? Yes, Mexico should be concerned about their southern border. But we do give Mexico a lot of money. Or is this more about the NAFTA? We've been talking about it this week and last week. It hasn't been ratified. Mexico, the new president, is saying, no, take off those tariffs or we're not going to go through with this. This still has to go through, you know, our government up until September, whether we choose to do it or not. Haven't heard much from Canada lately about it. They're probably just sitting back and saying, well, hey, you know, trade is the same as it was. You know, there's a little few changes, but, you know, the agreement hasn't been ratified yet, so nothing is in effect yet. So Canada is probably just being really quiet. Of course, he's got his own problems up there in Canada. So, and you know what? I listen to some of these stories. And sometimes the stories that I hear listening to what's happening down at the border, yeah, we have a problem. But now some of the stories and it almost sounds like it, you know, maybe it's just the government that is just incompetent. Sometimes it sounds like these are just Keystone cops down there. What are they doing down there? Who's in charge? Who's responsible? Homeland Security? ICE? The federal government? The state governments? It was all about the wall. But now that that's taken care of, now you're hearing all these other stories, and I'm sorry, it does sound, it's just incompetency down there. But anyway, that's just my view and some of the stories that I hear, the pictures that I've seen, the comments that I made, even from the conservatives. I'm thinking, what is wrong? What is going down on down there? But back to what President Trump said at the meeting at the White House today, the Opportunity and Revitalization Council. If in a year from now drugs can continue to pour in, we're going to put tariffs up. We're going to shut the border. And so, you know, that's, you know, it's kind of interesting. We know, you know, the talks of closing the border to commerce. And I guess someplace in Texas, they did close down something temporarily. I'm not even quite sure what that was about, or they're closing down a lot, but they're keeping one lane open or something like that, you know, because they didn't have, they had to remove the those that monitored that particular road coming into the United States in, I don't know if it was El Paso, that they had to move those to go someplace else that they couldn't monitor that road, so they closed it. That's what I mean by this is just incompetency in my mind. Can I do a better job, or is it easy? Yeah, it's easy to sit back and say, yeah, you know, what's going on down there? But anyway, so interesting as this unfolds. And we're also now looking to see if $15 an hour minimum wage is not enough. The new Democratic Socialists of America, embraced by everyone who wants something for nothing, are now attempting to force businesses to contribute to retirement plans. And they'll pay for it by raising taxes on the wealthy. This is actually a bill that was introduced by Senators Chris Coons of Delaware and Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. And they would require businesses to pay at least 50 cents into an employee retirement plan for every hour worked. And to pay for the proposal, the senators are proposing raising the corporate tax rate by 2 percentage points to 23%. Many companies that are currently offering pensions or provide matching contributions would already be in compliance. Does anybody see what's wrong with this? We'll probably talk more about this because I'm running out of time. We're getting ready to go into a break here in 20 seconds. And I want to remind everyone to make sure you call Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And James Corbett will be joining the program here in just a few minutes. But this is really amazing how they plan to offset the costs. And how these companies, and always the wealthy is going to pay for it. Always the wealthy, always the wealthy. Take from one and give to another. We don't do things that way. And then I also have a wish list of some of these Democrats on some of their proposals on these that are running for president. We'll talk more about this tomorrow, too. They have a huge wish list. And guess who gets to pay for it, ladies and gentlemen? 1-800-375-4188. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you for your patience. And James Corbett will be joining you in just a few short minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and as always, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And yes, you know that James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report. It was founded in 2007, 2012. He became the editorial writer, lead writer for the International Forecaster. And of course, we know the Forecaster was created by our good friend Bob Chapman. You can visit James' website at thecorbettreport.com. I encourage you to do so. And you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster just by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Well, hello, James.
Well, good morning, as we say on this side of the dateline.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. As usual, we like to start off the show asking you if there's anything on particular on your mind today, but today it's going to be a little bit different. My first question to you is about Japan's emperor abdicating his throne to, and so maybe perhaps you'd like to speak about that, and what does it mean?
All right. Well, funnily enough, that's the subject of my last International Forecaster editorial. So for people who haven't read it, it's up right now on theinternationalforecaster.com and on corporatereport.com. Japan's emperor is abdicating. Here's what it means. And long story short, well, I guess we should start at the beginning, because some people might think, does Japan have an emperor? Well, yes, Japan has an emperor. In fact, it is the longest continuously operating hereditary monarchy in the world at this point. And it is called the Chrysanthemum Throne. And it supposedly, at least according to legend and myth, dates back to 660 BC, where the first emperor Jimmu took the throne. But according to legend, he is a literal descendant of the sun goddess Amaterasu. So there's a little bit murky on the history there. We're not really sure. But at any rate, it has been around for millennia now. And the current emperor is Emperor Akihito, who is the son of Haruhito, who, of course, was the emperor during World War II. And I don't even know how to begin explaining this. Haruhito is now known as Emperor Showa, because each emperor in the Japanese system has his own era. So in Japan, in the Japanese calendar, it is not the year 2019. It is the year Heisei 31, because we are currently in the reign of Emperor Akihito, who, when he dies, will be known as Emperor Heisei, for the era name that is currently ongoing. Are you keeping track of this at home? And so he has been reigning for 31 years, so it is now Heisei 31. But, as you just mentioned, he is abdicating his throne, which is something of a big deal, because it's the first time in the last two centuries that an emperor has abdicated. Generally, an emperor dies and is replaced by the next in line. Well, this one, he's 85 years old, and he has decided that he can't keep up with the breakneck pace of going and having tea with foreign royalty and whatever. So he is giving up the throne to his eldest son, the crown prince Naruhito, who is going to be enthroned on May 1st. So that will be technically the start of a new era, and thus it will be back to the year one for Japan, which brings in some interesting problems, because as you might do with some little mental arithmetic, Heisei 1 started back in 1989. So that was an era where, yes, there was home computing, but not a lot. We certainly weren't in the constantly wired 24/7 online world that we're in now, back in 1989. So this is the first emperor era changeover that's taking place in the era of modern computing. So there's something of a Y2K kind of crisis that people are expecting might happen here in Japan. or might not happen, like Y2K. At any rate, people are worried because Heisei 31 is going to change over to Reiwa 1. The new era name is going to be called Reiwa, so it's going to be the first year of the Reiwa era as of May 1st, and people are wondering, well, all these databases and everything that are currently, we're in the year 31, we're going to go to the year 1, it might cause chaos and havoc and mess up servers and what have you. So there's a big deal about that going on right now. And some other ancillary things that are kind of just strange. For example, this is all taking place during Golden Week, which is called Golden Week because it is a time at the end of April, beginning of May, when generally 5 consecutive holidays in a row line up here in Japan, which is amazing in a country where most people do not take extended vacations, i.e. anything over a few days. To have 5 national holidays in a row and to have a whole week, basically, of holidays is an incredible thing. That's why they call it Golden Week. Well, this year, Golden Week is going to be even better because now with the all the brouhaha and festivities surrounding the new emperor and everything, it's going to be 10 whole days in a row off. Can you imagine? There's going to be 2 weeks of holidays here. But that's going to cause other problems. For example, all of the electricity grid is calibrated to people using a lot of energy in the day and then tailoring off at night. So with people on holiday, that's going to change energy consumption patterns. People are worried there's going to be an oversupply of electricity because obviously a lot of industry is going to be shut down for those 2 weeks. So there's going to be too much electricity, which will create blackouts potentially. So they're actually advocating, you know, you should use more power during the day so that we don't have blackouts. All this craziness is happening. But long story short, yes, the emperor here is abdicating and we're about to start a new era in what is going to be, I'm sure, not a great era for Japan because of the demographic crunch that we all know is coming here.
How old is the crown prince?
I know this. Hold on just a second. I think he's 59. He is 59 years young, born in 1960. So he is considerably younger than the current 85-year-old emperor, who's the one that people in Japan are used to seeing, basically seeing the emperor as this old man kind of, you know, bent over. He can still walk and get around and everything, but he's clearly an old man. So it's going to be different to have a relatively young, sprightly 59-year-old as the emperor, and that might make a difference in terms of seeing a little bit more photo op kind of things with that. I mean, all of this is kind of new because it wasn't really until this current emperor that the emperor really made much public appearance at all. In fact, the first time that the Japanese public ever heard Emperor Haruhito, now known as Emperor Showa, the first time they ever heard him speak was in the address at the end of World War II to announce the surrender of Japan. That was the first time most Japanese people had ever heard him speak. So the emperor is generally not someone who's visible. In fact, at the current emperor, Akihito, when he announced he was going to step down, essentially, back in 2016, that was his second ever televised address, ever. So the second time the people had ever seen him give a speech on television was him basically announcing he was going to step down. So it's entirely possible that Emperor Crown Prince Naruhito, about to become Emperor Naruhito, will be more kind of telegenic and might be more of a public interface, but maybe not. Who knows? The Japanese imperial system is kind of weird. It's not only a figurehead in the way that, say, the Queen is kind of the figurehead of England, but it's even more of a figurehead position than that, because at the very least, the Queen is technically, legally, the chief executive of the constitutional monarchy of Great Britain. But in Japan, that function has been stripped from the emperor. That was one of the conditions of the surrender of Japan back in World War II, is that the emperor is not even a figurehead leader in any sense. It's just a figurehead position that has not even the pretense of a political backing to it.
I did not know that was an agreement at World War II.
In fact, that was one of the I think the only stipulation back in the summer of 1945 that the Japanese had. We will surrender, but we want to keep our emperor. And the U.S. basically said, nope, dropped a couple of nukes on them. And they said, okay, whatever, we're going to surrender. We'll surrender. But they ended up being allowed to keep the emperor, but on the condition that he is not even the figurehead leader of the government.
Do the people still recognize him, like, on their own as far as more than just
there
a free,
are,
or is
it's
it?
Interesting. So the political position is that the sort of the extreme far right that look back to the imperial days of Imperial Japan as the kind of warmongers of the East Asia still think of the emperor as the literal descendant of the gods, and so literally a god on earth kind of thing. And so it's a very important political kind of figurehead position for those people who want a return to sort of militaristic imperialistic Japan. And that, of course, now with Abe in power, and he has links to some of those groups and is trying to change the constitution, for example, so that Japan will renounce its pacifist ways or at least embrace a little bit more of its militaristic past. So the Japanese emperor kind of has this position where it's just a figurehead position, but a lot of political energy is projected onto it, shall we say. Akihito does not come across as a warmongering, you know, bloodthirsty descendant of all these imperial, you know, warmongers, but I think that that is kind of the political position that he holds. And I don't know the real reason. I'm sorry to say, I don't have the inside track on why he is really abdicating. Is it really just because he's old? I mean, for hundreds of years, as I say, for the last two centuries, not a single emperor has abdicated. They've all died on the job. So why is he abdicating now? It could very well be because Japan is turning a little bit more militaristic and the right wing very much venerates the emperor position at any rate and wants that emperor to be a figurehead for a more militaristic turn in Japan, and maybe Akihito didn't want to go along with that. But that's all just speculation on my part. I don't have anything to back that up, but it's certainly a possibility. Anyway, so politically speaking, the far right embraces the emperor as a god on earth and all of this, but the average Japanese person does not care about or think about the emperor at all. In fact, one of the anecdotes I relate in my article is that I had a student here when I was teaching English who was excited for Crown Prince Naruhito to become emperor one day because he shares a birthday with Naruhito, and in Japan, the emperor's birthday is a national holiday. So basically, he'd get a national holiday whenever Naruhito becomes emperor. Well, he's about to get his wish.
Well, very good. Are you going to participate in any of the celebrations? Or
absolutely not. In fact, my family's going to Vietnam for a little vacation during that beautiful 10-day Golden Week, so we'll get away from all the craziness over here.
So are you going to be back in 2 weeks?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. I just find it fascinating, and this is something that, you know, we wouldn't get so involved in what's happening today. We really don't look around the world and see, you know, how, you know, other cultures and societies and so forth. And, you know, it's fascinating. So, you mentioned when, you know, prior to, our little chat before we came on the program about China and the U.S. trade agreement. We talked a little bit about it today, that they were close and that China had actually admitted to perhaps stealing a little technology and maybe doing a little cyber hacking and so forth, but I didn't think they had actually come to any terms as far as, you know, they wouldn't do it again and any other agreements. Do you have a little more information on that, James?
Well, I don't believe it's been finally finalized. I think things are still ongoing. But Bloomberg is apparently reporting, and this is fresh off the press, so I don't have the details on this. But Bloomberg is reporting that some details are coming out about the trade deal that is being finalized, which, according to Bloomberg sources, this is coming from Zero Hedge, who's summarizing this, would give Beijing until 2025 to meet commitments on commodity purchases and allow American companies to wholly own enterprises in the Asian nation. So the long story short, by 2025, so 5-6 years from now, China would commit to buy more U.S. commodities, including soybeans and energy products, and allow 100% foreign ownership for U.S. companies operating in China. Something to note about that 2025 deadline. So that would be a binding pledge that could trigger retaliation if it was left unfulfilled. But something to note about that 2025 deadline, of course, that's after the next presidential election. So even if Trump is reelected, it would be after his second term. So it has no political consequences whatsoever to Trump. It's just something he can say, yeah, we're working on that. It's going to be, you know, 2025. So it's essentially utterly meaningless. And on top of that, even more meaningless, some other hilarious/non-binding promises, as Zero Hedge points out, that China has offered to implement by 2029 wouldn't be tied to U.S. retaliation. So utterly, totally meaningless. So I think this is just sort of news in order to boost the stocks that were slipping into red territory for the day. Well, here's a little boost for you. Hey, here's some nuggets from the ongoing negotiations. Now, the negotiations are still going on, and apparently U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin are going to be holding planned meetings with Chinese Vice Premier Liu He over the next few days. So nothing's been finalized yet, but Bloomberg is getting the inside skinny on this very important non-binding, ridiculous pie-in-the-sky quote-unquote deal that's coming together.
You know, there was where China was going to commit, what, $1.3 trillion or something like that into our agriculture and things like that, and you break it down, and again, they take it out to 2024, 2025. So it's like all past, you know, if Trump gets elected again, it's, you know, past his term. He doesn't get blamed for it. It's so much of it. It's like just like the NAFTA agreement. That's still not ratified. It could be next September or not at all. And there's no word. I read recently, I think it was an article in the first part of March, where the Mexico is saying, nope, you need to take off the aluminum and steel tariffs.
This is a very common political tactic to just kick the can as far down the road as you need to. And in this case, for Trump, it would obviously be anything past 2024. He doesn't have to worry about, so who cares, right? And so I wouldn't trust any deal that's being inked that has some political promise for 2025 or non-binding promises for 2029. It's just completely meaningless.
But helps the stock market, doesn't it?
Yeah, and in fact, that was Zero Hedge's cynical tweet. They said S&P to hit 36,000 by 2025, rising on China trade deal optimism every day for the next 5 years. that's probably about right.
Yeah. And gold will be a dollar, right?
yeah, exactly, right.
The extremes. Well, Brexit. I thought I saw they had another vote. I was kind of looking at the news. I guess she might be getting, I think she might have gotten an extension for a couple weeks or something like that. I think she got it by one vote, but is this country prepared for a no deal Brexit? I mean, we know the nuclear option of revoking the UK's Article 50. Is the UK in chaos? Will it be in chaos with this Brexit deal?
Yeah. Yes and yes. And I think that was actually really part of the plan here ever since people voted the wrong way. The whole point has been to basically do a controlled demolition of this to make sure nothing gets through so that it would result in chaos so people would clamor for the order of, oh, let's go back and be the EU.
Well, we're going to go back into our break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with James Corbett. And we ended the segment talking about Brexit. And the last program, we had James, his views, and he wrote about free will and about computers and how they're shaping, we're being shaped, our experiences directed, our choices are made for us each and every day. And we have less and less say over our own decisions. And you also wrote about if man has no free will, then how can there be moral responsibility? I take it a little bit further. To me, it becomes a little more religion. If God gave us free will and there is no longer free will, then this really does show us that it's a battle of evil and good. But that's, you know, that's taken in a different direction. I don't know what to say about this.
It's interesting you bring up the religious angle, because I think there are a couple of religious tie-ins to this. One, the most obvious of which, is the newest religion that's been created, the Way of the Future. I don't know if your audience is familiar with it. It's called Way of the Future. It's at wayofthefuture.church. And Way of the Future is a church for those who want to create a peaceful and respectful relationship with artificial intelligence. This is a literal religion that has been founded by some Silicon Tech insider who started this religion to worship the coming AI godhead a couple of years ago. Literally, the idea being, once we create this AI and we have the singularity moment where it starts improving itself and we're not in control of it anymore, and suddenly you've got this artificial intelligence that is billions of times smarter than the smartest human being who's ever lived, it will essentially be a god. It will be able to predict the future and know all sorts of things that we can't even possibly understand. It'll essentially be God, so we should worship it, and we should make sure that we're at least on the right side of the relationship with that, because, you know, otherwise we'll just be like ants to it, so it'll want to crush us. Well, hey, maybe if we worship it, it'll treat us nice, or something like that. Maybe I'm giving a bit of a short shrift to it, but people can look it up. It's literally a church that has been founded to worship artificial intelligence, and I think that's the way people are being prepped to look at this coming singularity that's coming, is essentially it's going to be your God.
Well, we talked about a survey. It was done in Europe, and I don't have all the numbers right in front of me, but I mean, you're talking about a huge percentage of people want, and we kind of laughed at this a little bit, but we did talk seriously about it, about replacing politicians with artificial intelligence, with robots. And it's...
And again, this is an idea with a much longer pedigree than a lot of people might think. The first thing that a lot of people, at least steeped in internet and alternative media culture, might think of is about a decade ago, there was the Zeitgeist documentary and a couple of follow-up documentaries that were just talking about the creation of a society based on, it was going to be based on science, and it was going to get rid of all of these these troubling parts of capitalism where you have waste and fraud and greed and everything baked into the cake. Well, if everything was just managed by this really benevolent computer that could sort of tell everyone what to produce and how much to produce and all of this, and basically just sort out society so that, you know, humans and human greed didn't come into it, then everything would be better. And it was presented as this bold new idea for engineering society on a technical basis. Well, hopefully for my listeners, that will bring to mind technocracy, which is a literal political movement that formed in the 1930s that was this idea, we're moving into this bold new age of industrial production and mechanical, you know, everything, so why don't we get the engineers and the scientists and people who know what's best for society to run society, and we'll make it as essentially, although this was framed in the 1930s in a much kind of cruder way, but essentially it was the idea that we are now coming into of an Internet of Things to monitor and track every single purchase that's being made in the economy in real time, so we can calculate how much energy is being devoted to each piece of production and what resources need to be allocated where. And if you just have a benevolent team of scientists and engineers, or hey, a benevolent artificial intelligence looking over this process, then we can engineer society on that level, and basically we will be told by the machines what to do. And people are now, I think, being steeped in that idea to the point where they're going to willingly embrace it. Hey, it's got to be better than these stupid Congress critters or whatever, so hey, let's give it a try. I agree the Congress critters are probably not the people we want to be in charge of this thing, but I'm telling you, I don't think we want artificial intelligence or any other kind of computer being to be in charge of this either, because it's always a question of what parameters is this quote-unquote artificial intelligence using to determine what's best for society, and what if you happen to disagree? What if you don't want to slot into this particular place in society and become a drone working in this particular sector so that you can produce, you know, this widget to produce this type of society? What if you don't enjoy that? What does that mean for the future? Again, this is all stuff we've thought about before, Brave New World and all of that, but it's real choices that people are going to have to make in the near future if they continue to embrace these ideas.
You know, author Douglas Rushkoff said that we're being steamrolled by our own devices. You know, his new book, Team Human, he argues that digital technology is eroding human freedom and destroying communities. And I guess this is the same thing that you're saying. He says we live in a consumer democracy that restricts human connections and stokes whatever appetites guarantee the greatest profit. So, you know, he talks about that if he wants to reestablish a sense of community in the digital world, we have to become conscious users of our technology, not passive objects. But if you look at the people around the world, that's exactly what they are, passive objects. So I can't see it changing.
Yeah, that's the problem, because clearly the inertia is on the side of the big tech giants. There are enough people out there that now think the internet is Google and YouTube and Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram and these controlled platforms that we've been given to connect with each other, quote-unquote, online. But as people have pointed out, you're not, you know, you don't have Facebook friends. They're all Zuckerberg's friends. And he'll take them away at a moment's notice, as actually happened last year with a great big purge of alt media voices. A bunch of people got their pages deleted. Thankfully, I didn't have to worry about that because I'm not on Facebook and no plans to ever be. But if you are on these controlled platforms, then you can be engineered and controlled and corralled, and there are many different ways to do that. There's shadow banning, and you could put people in filter bubbles so basically no one will ever find you, and all of these different things, or they can just censor you outright. But we will be corralled into different pens and allowed to interact with each other to the extent that it benefits those in charge of the system. And the worst part of all of this, of course, I mean, the long-term game plan of all of this, when you think about it, humans, the human factor becomes less and less important as the machine factor becomes more and more important. As the Georgia Guidestones and other, these other things have talked about for a very long time, the ultimate plan is to get human population down to something manageable, you know, 500 million people or something. Why do we need 7, 8, 10 billion people? Why don't we have 500 million easily controllable people in this completely alternative structure of society that's been created in this this high-tech society? You know, that humans are not going to be needed as much in the future. And if we are not needed, you can imagine that people at the very top who like to think of themselves as God emperors, socially engineering all of us, will start to question at some point, why do we need so many of these useless eaters, as they like to refer to us as?
And, you know, you hear more and more about, we need to regulate, forget the regulating the tech companies. We'll just regulate the algorithms and so forth. And, you know, government will have to create a new department. It's like, oh, that's the last thing we want to have.
Yeah. What was it? My friend James Evan Pilato, Media Monarchy, just shared with me. Apparently, there was some journalist who was talking to Dianne Feinstein about that recent video that went viral about her, some children confronting her. Oh, won't you do something? something about the environment, you know, it's global warming is going to kill us all. And that exchange went viral online. And so Feinstein was confiding in this reporter, do you know people can take videos with their cell phone and many people can watch them? And I didn't know about that. It's like you are literally, what, 3 or 4 people away from the presidency and you don't even understand anything about the internet? And we're going to put the government in charge of regulating this?
I know. Buy gold and silver, ladies and gentlemen. You know,
yes,
more.
Yes.
But, okay, now I'm going to ask you if you have anything in particular you'd like to share with the listeners.
Well, why don't I give a little bit of a preview of this weekend's forecaster? And I haven't finished all my research for it, but so it's a bit scattershot at the moment. But essentially, I'm going to be writing about the idea of a changeover in world reserve currency, which is something I've talked about quite a bit in the past, and I'm sure is not unfamiliar to people, the idea of the death of the dollar, or at least the death of the dollar as the world reserve currency that all central banks need to hold in order to settle international transactions and basically feed into the current exchange rate mechanism, which, of course, everything is measured against the dollar, including gold and everything else. Well, why? Why is it the dollar? Well, it's because that, in the post-Bretton Woods system that was created, obviously post-World War II, and then in the 1970s being refined when the dollar was took off the gold standard, the dollar has been the international giant of international trade and settlement. But that is changing, as we know, and we've talked about this many times, about Saudi Arabia and the petrodollar and how that system may be undermined as Saudi Arabia starts to cozy up to China, and what can that mean, and China starting to do its gold exchange and China stockpiling gold. Well, some of the latest information on this front involves Russia, which people have been keeping their eye on and have noticed Russia has been stockpiling gold for at least the last year, but also simultaneously dumping dollar reserves. So now they're not even in the top 30 of countries that are holding dollars in reserve. Russia has completely fallen off that list. They are dumping the dollar. They are buying gold. Well, why? Obviously, because they can read the writing on the wall, and they know that the U.S. dollar's position as world reserve currency allows the U.S. to have the kind of leverage that it has over the international geopolitical order. So, you know, Putin and many others are reading the writing on the wall and stocking gold and dumping dollars because they don't want Washington to dictate the world policy, and they know that at some point that rug is going to be pulled out. But a lot of people, I think, tend to think of that changeover that is happening and is going to happen as the dollar will be replaced by another national currency. And some people might even say something like the Chinese yuan, which is kind of ridiculous at this point because the yuan is just not convertible and it wouldn't work as a world reserve currency. Another thing that has been floated and that I've talked about before, the IMF with their special drawing rights, which is a kind of a central bank currency essentially, that the China and others have been arguing for years should be something more like what the world reserve currency is in the future. But actually, I'm beginning to think that the real game plan is to engineer a type of central bank administered blockchain cryptocurrency. So not like Bitcoin or something that's actually decentralized, but essentially a Fed coin of some sort or other, administered by some central bank or perhaps the IMF or something like that, will be what will ultimately be used to replace the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. Because it has to be something, I think, that goes in line with the globalist overall game plan, which, of course, is to engineer a global world order. You can't do that with a nation-state system that is built on the sovereignty of nation states and individual nation currencies, national currencies like the U.S. dollar. It has to be something that ties them together. And that's why the special drawing rights, I think, has been pointed to as a potential for the future world currency. But even beyond that, clearly it's going to involve fintech. And I'm thinking about this specifically because I just talked to Patrick Wood about his latest book, Technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order, where he talks about fintech and the ways that central banks are now starting to look at blockchain currencies. And he points out some interesting ones like Earth dollars, which is a type of cryptocurrency that's apparently being developed that is backed by natural capital assets. They are what they call tokenizing all of the natural assets held in United Nations heritage, World Heritage Sanctuaries, you know, those UN World Heritage Sites and everything, have resources that then they are saying, okay, those resources in that site is worth X number of billions or trillions of dollars, so we're going to create that much currency to that is essentially backed up by those resources. It will be administered as part of the global commons, and it will uphold the Universal Declaration of Rights of Mother Earth and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and all of this pie-in-the-sky nonsense that's all about Agenda 2030 in the United Nations. And I think something like that, not necessarily Earth dollars, although people should take a look at Earth dollars. It's a bizarre idea. But something like that, I think, is the direction we're being channeled into. And that's what I'm going to be writing about, the idea of a new world reserve currency not being a nation-state currency at all, but being some sort of fintech monstrosity created by the central banks.
Well, you know, we often talk about that. My idea was, you know, in order to unite, you have to tie things together. And truly, yeah, I get the crypto and all that, the blockchain, not the crypto, but the blockchain and so forth. But something still has to tie it together. And to me, I just can only see gold by doing that. It has to be a part of the system, because the whole idea is they all manipulate their currencies. And so it will all be about a trade unit, whether it be, you know, some sort of a blockchain and so forth. But what every country out there for trade, what are they going to accept? You know, something has to
I understand what you're saying. There has to be something real in the system.
Something real.
Yeah.
To tie it all together, to make it acceptable to all these countries, to have them to eliminate.
Because how are people going to buy on board with it? Well, that's the thing.
Because
it's
just another fiat currency then.
That's why I think they're trying to tie it into resources via these World Heritage Sanctuaries or whatever else, whatever other scheme they come up with. It's going to be tied to resources, but they're going to be tokenized and put on the blockchain. And I think that's going to be the trick. And that's going to be how they'll inflate it, you know, to their purposes. And, you know, can we trust anything that they say, let alone about resources and reserve holdings and all of that? Probably not. But it'll be administered by some touchy-feely, fuzzy-wuzzy United Nations, IMF, something or other, some sort of globalist institution, so we can all trust it, right?
In the meantime, while they're working on that, everyone else is going broke in the world.
Yeah.
And they'll lose everything. Thank you, James. I appreciate joining Discount Gold and Silver Financial Survival. Enjoy your holiday. And we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
There seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In